And now it is my distinct pleasure to introduce today's reviewer. When Behind the Beautiful Forevers was nominated to be a random review this year, I immediately thought, Jerry Olson, she is the perfect reviewer for this book. Jerry grew up in Wisconsin, which you could tell from her accent. And she began her career, actually, as a high school home economics teacher. I never knew that. But after a master's degree in this is not a good position, in household economics and management from Cornell, she became an extension specialist in family economics at Ohio State University, where she also completed her PhD. Now, Jerry has been here ever since then. She retired from our own OSU in 2001 after 25 years on the faculty of what started out then as the College of Home Economics, and which through many, many iterations since then has now become the College of Public Health and Human Sciences. Her first 15 years at OSU, Jerry was a department head of family resource management. And in that department, which doesn't exist anymore, undergraduate and graduate degrees were offered in family and consumer economics, family management systems, personal finance, and housing. Jerry's own major research related to family time use. She taught courses in household resource use and theory courses in household economics and management. Many of her graduate students were from developing countries in Africa and Asia, including India and Nepal. She and her graduate students studied how families in the developing world earn a living and how they use their limited resources to enhance the lives of their family members. Jerry is very well traveled. We got to know each other in the 1990s when we both participated in a U.S. Information Agency-funded exchange program with faculty colleagues at the Avinash Lingam Deemed University in the state of Tamil Nadu, in the southernmost state in India. But Jerry is far more adventurous than I ever was, and she has also consulted with a university in Andhra Pradesh, India, and she's participated in an exchange program in Nepal and traveled widely in India, including to Mumbai, where today's book takes place. Of course, at that time, it was still Bombay. And in her retirement, Jerry continues to travel to check up, so to speak, on the academic successes of her graduates. In retirement, in addition to travel in the U.S. and abroad, Jerry's involved with some local organizations. She's an officer with the OSU Retirement Association and with volunteer interfaith caregivers. And she's in a regular early morning exercise class for, as she says, both fun and profit. So please welcome Jerry Olson.
Thank you, Connie, for that very kind introduction. And I'll have you all bear with me because it occurred to me this morning I haven't really done a book report since I was in grade school. Maybe some of you are in that same position. Well, as I understand my task, it's to entice you to read this book. And I know the library has it available, and there are probably some other copies. I'll loan mine. It's not a hard job because it's hard to find a negative word about this book, no matter where you look on the internet. Everyone has been taken with it for one reason or another. But I need to judge the magnitude of my task. So how many of you have read this book? Okay, I see 8 or 10 hands, maybe. How many of you have been in India? Okay, maybe those same 8 or 10 hands. Well, if you raised your hands for both of those, you're as qualified as I am to review this book. So chime in, and perhaps you've already done some thinking about it. So please feel free to chime in. I'll try to bring my eyes up every now and then to catch hands. If you'd like to make a point that I didn't, or if you'd like to ask a question, I can try to field those as well. I'm going back a little bit back and forth on the mic. Is it okay for the people in the back? Okay? Okay, let me know, kind of give me a signal if something happens, that because I'm looking down. I know I have limited time, and so I have a lot of words on paper. I don't necessarily like to read what I'm going to say, but I need to keep on track, so I will try to do that. Also, if any of you could help me in pronouncing some of the Indian words and names better than I do, I'd be most welcome for suggestions, and you can just let me know. By the way, that's pronounced some other way. Well, Behind the Beautiful Forevers, an interesting title, and you can put it on your list of nonfiction books. You get more credit for reading nonfiction, right? Kind of what I always thought. And so it seems to me you get more points. But if no one told you that this was a documentary, I don't think you'd know it. And more than that, if when you're reading it and you did know it, that it was a documentary, you might wish it was fiction. It's that kind of a book. Do you know Catherine Boo? I'm going to share some slides with you. I don't have a lot, but I'm going to go back and forth, and so I'll tell you a little of my strategy here. I've got a few slides of this area, of Mumbai and of the region that we're talking about, and a Google Earth shot or two where we can imagine we're looking at Anawadi, which is the slum that this takes place in. And so I'm going to use my pointer here when I need to. And I'm hoping you can see that light's not fading it too much. But I will, this is my process. I go to the next one. So it's a slideshow, but one by one as I want it to happen. This is Catherine Boo. She's a writer, and this is her first book. But for the past 20 years or so, she has been a reporter on the real lives of poor people in the United States, primarily in the East. And she's been reporting and is interested in the real lives of poor people, with the idea that if you really understand what's happening in these communities, perhaps the solutions and problems that we might come up with would be better suited to the target audience, and that's how she comes about it. Anyway, more real than the statistics that we're likely to use as a basis for our policies. She's currently a staff writer at The New Yorker and a former reporter and editor for The Washington Post. Her reporting has been awarded a Pulitzer Prize, a MacArthur Genius Grant, and a National Magazine Award for feature writing. She is married to an Indian professor, and she shares her time between the United States and Mumbai. I want to move on. Now, let's see if I can get the right buttons here. You all know where Indian and Mumbai is, right here, Bombay, when I was there. Connie mentioned that both she and I were in the southern state, Tamil Nadu, and that comes up in the book. And so I want you to kind of remember where that is, with the Arabian Sea and the Bay of Bengal, and I'm not going to even pronounce the name of that sea. But anyway, so it's considered South India. And it is right on the Arabian Sea. Mumbai. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about this, and I am going to go back and forth between what Catherine Boo writes and what I've written, because her words are glorious, and she manages to share the magic of this documentary in so many ways. Excuse me. The setting for the book is Anawadi, India, a slum squeezed between the international airport of Mumbai and a row of luxurious hotels designed to attract tourists. And when I was in Mumbai, I was one of those tourists. This is the international airport, a local airport. I stayed somewhere in a hotel on Juhu Beach, so I can't really claim to have seen Anawadi. But Anawadi is one of 30 rather identical slums that are located in this area. And so you can think about that when I show you the photos that I took. I want to tell you what she writes about Anawadi. Anawadi is built on land that belongs to the Airports Authority of India. It's not owned land, it's squatter rights, right? Only a coconut-lined tree thoroughfare separates the slum from the entrance to the international terminal. Serving the airport clientele and encircling Anawadi are five extravagant hotels, four ornate marbly megaliths, and one sleek blue glass Hyatt, from the top floors of which Anawadi and several ancient squatter settlements look like villages that have been dropped into the gaps between elegant modernities. Let's say that one again. And the next line, I debated about reading or not, but this is how one of the youngsters who lives in this village says, everything around us is roses, and we're the shit in between. From the people who live there. They know where they are. Okay? Okay, so when I was there, and I was only in Mumbai a couple of days, coming and going a couple of different times, but I did take photos, and then when Connie asked me to do this, I said, no way can I find them, but then I did. This is not a photo I took, by the way. This is Google Earth. Actually, this is a photograph of a print from Google Earth that I try to enhance a little bit. But you can see the big airport, right? And you can see this little local airport and Juhu Beach along here. And the slums are tucked in between, and I'll show you some that are more close-up. That one I took. That's not of the slum. That's just India. That's the beach, and there are vehicles and vendors, and they kind of live there and sell things and peddle things and run things. People walking and the animals, and you can see all of that there. So horses and things going on at the beach. And that's the Arabian Sea. But that's one I took from my hotel window. Another one I took from, these are just more for fun, but you get the idea. There's a lot going on. There are a lot of people. And many of the tourists that are in these luxury hotels are, in fact, Indian people. They are from various parts of India. They are also tourists in Mumbai. That's the film city, the Bollywood city. So, carts for kids to ride in. And, there's some you can't resist taking. I think that's one. It might be the moon settling and going into evening. I can go through these pretty quickly. This is a view in the other direction from my window. And it looks to me a lot like what is described. And I'm going to give you more information about the dwellings and the places where people lived. But this is pretty much like what I saw. These photos I'll go through quickly. They were taken from a moving vehicle, so you can kind of see they are a little blurred.
but people gathering, and there are a couple of them that I especially want you to see. The walls that were built around the slum areas, trying to block them off, because the people in Mumbai who are running Mumbai know that the tourists and the business people they want to attract don't want to see the slums. They don't want Mumbai to be interpreted in that way. So you see that. Things hanging everywhere, fabrics becoming dividers. And this one, a better picture of the wall. Probably cooking, sleeping, young lad standing there, I'm not sure. But you can tell that these are what Catherine Boo calls the road boys. They sleep along the road, usually on top of the trash they've been gathering so no one will steal it during the night. Okay, we're back to, I don't know how I messed up that. I think that wasn't there. But this is part of the airport here. And this is Subhar Road, the International Airport Road, I believe. You can see some of the hotels around, and it's impossible to know. But it could be in this area. I'm not sure. Where that coconut line tree thoroughfare is, could be along here. Could be along here. I can't tell. And with Google Earth, your house may come up very distinct, so you can tell the color of your car in the driveway. This area does not come up clear and distinct. This is about as clear as you can get it. They're not really focusing in or giving you front door views. But it is, you can see at least at some of the area. Again from Google Earth, you can see the hotels that were growing up. Now, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the time frame. These were probably taken in the last year or two, so it's a little later than when the book was set. I better move along quickly here. And another one. This is part of the airport, and it walls through. This is very likely where some of this took place. But, you know, you can use your imagination for that. Okay. As I said, the slum is one of 30 in the area, and it was built on uninhabitable land owned by the airport. Construction workers were brought from Tamil Nadu, and you saw where that was, into this airport area to help expand and build the international airport in order to attract business and tourists. The construction workers were brought to Mumbai in 1991. And by 2007, which is really the beginning of this documentary, 16 years later, this is a half an acre of land. I don't even know what a half an acre looks like, but some of the rest of you may have better ideas of that. On that half acre were 335 huts and 3,000 residents in just this slum, in just in Annawadi. It's a fluid population, people coming and going all the time, all religions, castes, and subcastes, languages and dialects. By current Indian standards, however, these residents were declared not to be poor. They did not fall in the poverty line, under what we call a poverty line. I don't know if they have the same kind of thing. They built the area by tearing out snake-infested shrubbery, filling in wetland with dirt, erecting bamboo poles, and then draping them with empty cement sacks. Over time, they added perhaps tin roofs. They're all hand-built. They're lopsided and off-kilter. Sometimes they use sheets as dividers between the huts. Some are made of aluminum scraps and reject bricks, which are weak and crumbling. Some have plaster walls. Others are held together by duct tape and rope. Floors are sodden, and water has to be carried generally twice a day from central spigots, which at least they have. But the type of hut a family has
is a symbol of relative wealth, even in this area, or lack of it. If you happen to have a ceiling fan, a shrine with an electric candle, a non-functioning refrigerator, larger spaces with side rooms or areas that can be rented out for cash, these are symbols of wealth in this community and much sought after. The lowest are the road boys, and they're the rag pickers that I like to think I had a picture of there for you to see. Okay, the highest economic dwellings, or the highest level of dwellings in terms of wealth in this area, are those that are near the public toilets. You know, it's close and handy. And those toilets were probably a political favor when some official needed votes in order to get into office. Okay. Let's see where we're at. The economic climate at the time that Catherine begins her research was one of rapid growth, 2007, spurred on especially by China's demand for metals and the tourism business. And this was the basis for quite a bit of optimism on the part of all Indians, including those in Anahuasi. It's not hard, then, for you to see what's coming. Do you remember 2008? Okay. And this time span goes from 2007 to 2011 for this documentary. While a downturn in the economy may cause all of us to cut back a little bit, and some of us, many of us did in this country, but when there's no place to cut that doesn't bleed, the impact can be devastating. In Anahuasi, where neighbors compete fiercely for an edge in the garbage trade under the most oppressive of conditions, tempers flare and bad things happen. The book itself is based on over three years, conducted by Catherine Boo from November 2007 to March 2011. She had notes from interviews, observations, translations by college students and other young professional Indian people who were working with her, mostly women, videos, audio tapes, photographs, and, if you can imagine, if you've been in the research dungeons, over 3,000 documents from public records, police reports, courts, hospitals, morgues, public health data, and political and election reports. How did she manage to do this? You saw her picture, right? Well, these are her words. My reporting wasn't pretty. My reporting wasn't pretty, especially at first. To Anahuasians, I was a reliably ridiculous spectacle, given to toppling into the sewage lake while videotaping and running afoul of the police. However, residents had concerns more pressing than my presence. After a month or two of curiosity, they went more or less about their business as I chronicled their life. And then, together over the course of 3 years, she and her colleagues wrestled with the question of whether days in rat-filled Anahuasi garbage sheds and late-night expeditions with thieves at a glamorous new airport had anything to contribute to an understanding of the pursuit of opportunity in an unequal, globalized world. Maybe, we firmly concluded. And I wasn't going to read this, but I just do want to tell you, in her words again, as I reported this and many other aspects of the narrative in which facts were hotly contested, I found Anahuasi children to be the most dependable witnesses. They were largely indifferent to the political, economic, and religious contentions of their elders and unconcerned about how their accounts might sound.
So she got really very smart and a great deal of information in this 3+ years. Okay. Well, one reason to read this book is to see how Catherine Boo magically turns sort of maybe dull or at least not very exciting statistics and court reports and police reports into a compelling, spellbinding, sometimes tragic narrative of the lives of selected, and I'm going to tell you who these guys are, selected, vibrant, striving, resilient people who sometimes behave in appalling, conniving, lying, scheming, and corrupt ways, and many of whom you come to care about deeply. The characters. Let's see if we're there yet. I may have a few other slides, and we'll kind of go through this. These are more from Google Earth. You all can do that, too. Pretty much the same. These are ones that I took when I was there. These were slides that were closer to the hotel. And I'll just go through these. You can see there's an old cannon for kids to play on. She's pumping water as near as I can tell. And I'm going to talk about what's called, I call it the Maidan, M-A-I-D-A-N. It's a kind of the public square with nothing on it. And if any of you know a better, have a better pronunciation, I'd like that. But this blank, open, public space was very important when you think about how dense and crowded things were. And so that's what I like to think about that way. Closer up, you can see the hodgepodge of things I'm going to describe in a bit. Okay, the main characters. In reading this book, when I read it the first time, I got a little lost with all the names and the characters, and actually, there are not really very many that stand out, 5 or 6 that really are traced throughout the entire documentary. And I'll call it a story from time to time because it does really read like a story. But let me introduce you to the main characters. I'm going to watch my time a little better here. Abdul is somewhere between 16 and 19 years old. Nobody really knows. He's a buyer and seller of garbage collected by rag pickers, or he's a middleman in this Anawati village. He sorts some 60 types of paper, metals, plastics for resale to small recycling plants. With 10 years experience, so he's got a lot of, he started when he was 6, okay? He's quick and resourceful. He sees opportunities, and he's raised his Muslim family, and he's raised his Muslim family of 11 above the average wealth line or income line for Anawani residents. He makes about $11 a day. Loading his treasure on a dilapidated 3-wheel vehicle and braving the made road that goes from the airport to these small private recycling areas. He lives in fear of catastrophe. And in his words, this paragraph starts, "Avoid trouble." This was the operating principle of Abdul Hakim Hussein, an idea so fiercely held that it seemed imprinted on his physical form. He had deep-set eyes and sunken cheeks, a body work-hunched and wiry, the type that claimed less than its fair share of space when threading through people-choked slum lanes. Almost everything about him was recessed, save the pop-out ears and the hair that curled upward girlish whenever he wiped his forehead of sweat. A modest, missable presence was a useful thing in Anawati, the sumpy plug of slum in which he lived. Here, in the thriving western suburbs of the Indian financial capital, 3,000 people had packed into or on top of 335 huts. It was a continual coming and going of migrants from all over India.
Hindus mainly, from all manners of castes and subcastes. His neighbors represented beliefs and cultures so varied that Abdul, one of the slum's 36 Muslims, could not begin to understand them. He simply recognized Anawadi as a place booby-trapped with contentions, new and ancient, over which he was determined not to trip. For Anawadi was also magnificently positioned for a trafficker in rich people's garbage. She writes well, doesn't she? Okay, so that's Abdul, and he really is the main character in the book, and it follows him through the 3.5 years. Zeyrunnisa, or some such pronunciation, Zeyrunnisa is his mother, Abdul's mother, and the wife of Karam, her husband, and Abdul Mirchi, a younger brother, Kekishan, a married daughter who comes back to live at home, and Lalu, who is the 2-year-old, and the only one that Abdul really relates to in a loving way, plus 5 others. So there are 11 in that family. And I want to tell you a little bit about Zeyrunnisa, close enough. She's a tough negotiator, and she is the one who gets the better prices for the garbage that the rag pickers bring in. Karam is ill, having been the garbage sorter until his lungs failed him. Mirchi is self-described lazy and wants a clean job. His mother has hopes that he will do well in school, and that will lead to a better life for him. Okay. Zeyrunnisa is ambitious, and she and her husband have been putting away any extra money they had, and they had a little more than normal, towards land in Vasai. And I'm not sure where Vasai is, close to Mumbai, I believe, where they would move to provide a better place for their children to grow up. But, and if there's a turning point in the story, in the plot, this is it. And Zeyrunnisa was less and less sure she wanted to go to Vasai, less and less sure her husband would live to get there. She wanted a more hygienic home there, or here in Anawadi, in the name of her children's vitality. She wanted a shelf on which to cook without rat intrusions, a stone shelf, not some cast-off piece of plywood. She wanted a small window to vent the cooking smoke that caused the little ones to cough like their father. On the floor, she wanted ceramic tiles like the ones advertised on the beautiful forever wall. Tiles that could be scrubbed clean instead of broken concrete that harbored filth in each striation. With these small improvements, she thought her children might stay as healthy as children in Anawadi could. Okay. Whoops, I get my stacks mixed up here. So it seems unbelievable that what seemed like such a hopeful decision could result in such a disaster that changed and ruined lives of several families. You'll have to read it to find out what. And I will give you an aside here, and I know time's passing quickly, and I still have a few people to introduce. But on an aside, you might want to ask me, why on earth, if they're living on borrowed land in huts that are as bad as this, would they want to put their money into them? And the reason was that the Indian government knew that the airport, I mean, they wanted the slums gone. Every now and then a rumble went through. But they promised that those who lived in huts that could be identified as huts and that were relatively substantial would be given a home in another area. So they were willing to make those as good as they could be, despite, and in addition to all the other benefits as were described by Zeyrunnisa. Okay, maybe the other major character is One Leg. Okay.
She's a neighbor of the Husseins, and they share a wall. Now, that might give you a hint to why the reconstruction of the Hussein kitchen might be a problem. Okay? She was also named Sita or Fatima by her husband. Like the Husseins, she is Muslim. And they, her family and the Husseins, spent special religious holidays together. I might say she had three daughters. One of them died tragically in a bucket of water. She was sickly, and Fatima claimed to be somewhere else, but the girls reported she was at home, and she was sick. So Fatima's reputation isn't real good, but you might listen to the description, which I could not imagine writing. Fatima had become known in Adiwadi for a sexual need as blatant as her lipstick. Had she been another sort of woman, her affairs might have been a scandal. That she was disabled made them a joke, as were her spectacular rages, which enlivened many of an Adiwadi evening. Yeah, let's see. Fatima had refined her verbal arsenal early, giving the insults about the leg she was born with, which turned into a flipper past the knee. By 30, she could out-curse even Zehurnisa, and when a government program provided her with metal crutches, she was doubly armed. Strong in the shoulders, she brought the crutches down hard on neighbors she considered disrespectful. She threw the crutches, too, with uncanny aim. Okay. She was damaged and acknowledged it freely. She was illiterate, acknowledged that, too. But when others spoke of her fury as an ignorant animal thing, that was bakwas, or utter nonsense. Much of her outrage derived from a belated recognition that she was as human as anyone else. Sometimes the afternoon men left her money. Most were too poor to do so, but even the poorest of them helped her grasp what her parents had taken from her, those ashamed and shaming parents who'd hidden an imperfect daughter in their hut. It had been a daily punishment watching her siblings run off to school and return to suck up their parents' affections. I had such hate for myself back then, Fatima told Zehurnisa, whom she alternately relied on and then resented. All I heard was that I had been born wrong. Okay. So that begins to set the stage for some conflict. The next major character in the book is Asha. Asha is politically ambitious and aspires to be the next slumlord. Okay? She uses trickery, sex, and lies to gain power in Adiwadi through ties to the elected corporator, his name, a corporator of Ward 76. She's able to fix problems, sometimes problems she's created, at the slum level, and for a price. She diverts funds from grants. For example, the grant for the school that she got, and funds got diverted to other things she deemed more important, or maybe to put the shrine up in her house. And besides, the school didn't have to be running very many days in order to for the inspections to take place. And so the school barely existed. But that's what she lived to do. And she was in a somewhat favored position in terms of caste. And this statement, if it bothers you, well, then it bothers me. But Asha truly sees corruption as a genuine opportunity. And many did. Okay, so in Catherine Boo's word, Asha took note in that winter of hope, the slumlord of Adiwadi had gone batty and pious. In this reformation, I'm skipping around here, but in this reformation, 39-year-old Asha perceived an opportunity. Robert had lost his taste for power just as she was discovering her own. Let others thread the marigolds. Let others sort the trash. For the over-city people who wished to exploit Adiwadi and the under-city people who wished to survive it, she wanted to be the woman to see. Slumlord was an unofficial position, but residents knew who held it. The person chosen by local politicians and police officers to run the settlement according to the authorities' interests. Even in a rapidly modernizing India, female slumlords were relative rarities, and those women who managed to secure such power typically had inherited land claims or were stand-ins for powerful husbands. Asha had no claims. Her husband was an alcoholic, an itinerant construction worker, a man thoroughgoing only in his lack of ambition. As she'd raised their children, who are now teenagers, few neighbors thought of her as anyone's wife. She was simply Asha, a woman on her own. Had the situation been otherwise, she might not have come to know her own brain. Well, there are a couple of other characters there. Well, Manju I need to tell you about. Manju is a beautiful young Indian woman, Asha's daughter, who is about to graduate from college. She's acknowledged to be one of the beauties of the slum area and the only woman to have this opportunity to graduate from college. She runs the school, this sometimes school, and you've got to wonder what's going on, but she teaches the Anawadi children almost on her own time, and she becomes attached to them to her mother's dismay. I mean, that doesn't lead to anything politically in terms of power. And more than that, Manju is developing a conscience concerning her mother's corrupt manipulations, and she enjoys teaching those young slum children. Their son, Raul, is Murchie's age, Abdul's brother, and they are good friends. Mina is a 14-year-old, and she plays into the storyline, but she's a really good friend of Manju, and they meet nightly at the public toilets to talk. You know, no boys and girls club here. At 15, she's terribly depressed because the marriage contract that was created when she was a small child is about to come due, and it means she will have to return to a remote village. Not happy about that. And then there are various rag pickers whom you get to know and enjoy. Okay, Sunil, Kalu, some others. And I talked about a couple of the other features of this settlement, if you will. One is the lake, and the other one is the Maiden. The lake is the source of much that is ugly in Anawadi. Basically a dump for sewage, garbage, dead animals, blue plastic bags, listen, Corvallis, cigarette packs, etc., yielding infestations, disease, and overwhelming odors. And so, from page 7, late at night, the contractors modernizing the airport dump things in the lake. Anawadians also dump things there. Most recently, the decomposing carcasses of 12 goats. Whatever was in that soup, the pigs and dogs that slept in its shallows emerged with bellies stained blue. Some creatures survived the lake, though, and not only the malarial mosquitoes. As the morning went on, a fisherman waded through the water, one hand pushing aside cigarette packs and blue plastic bags, the other dimpling the surface with a net. He would take his catch to the Marol market to be ground into fish oil, a health product for which demand had surged now that it was valued in the West. Lovely. Okay. And the Maiden is this open area that I was talking about. It's beachfront for a vast pool of sewage. And I've just read about that. The various activities of the slum take place there. It is where Abdul sorts his garbage, and he also sleeps, as there's not room for 11 Husseins to sleep in their hut. The Maiden is a soapbox for anyone who wishes to shout insults or accusations at neighbors or politicians. Children play and teens gather there. Boys play cricket. feral pigs and water buffalo collect there. It's a gathering place for drama, music, public discourse, and fighting. One may cook there, eat there, bathe there. And it's a quiet, dark place at night. Much action of Anawati takes place in the Maidan. Well, I'm getting close to telling you as much as I am going to tell you about this book. I hope you've developed some questions and interest. But there are so many similarities between slums all over the world, including the United States. Bribery, corruption, greed, envy, distrust, addictions to alcohol, drugs. There was a lot of Erasex sniffing, that's white out for us. Sexual exploitation, rats, disease, threats to safety, crowding, illiteracy, fear, disillusionment, depression, and fierce competition. You still want to read this book? Also in evidence, however, intelligence, entrepreneurship, creativity, ingenuity and resourcefulness, resilience, the ability to survive, commitment to family and children, the ability to hope. I may have jeopardized a long-standing friendship with a former student of mine who has her doctorate in housing, and she's now on the faculty and in administration at Sacramento State University in California. But I sent her the book and asked her to read it. She grew up in India, more in Delhi. She has a brother living in Mumbai now. And it took her a long time to get back to me, and she said, "I'm sorry." She said, "It was so depressing, I put it aside." And, you know, she's heartsick. She's not doing anything for it herself. You know, the problems are wide and deep and there. But she was also the only one I found who was a bit critical of the reporting of Catherine Boo. She said, "The death and the sickness is so much worse than comes out in the book." And I think that's partly because Catherine Boo has taken very compelling characters and written about them. And they're mainly young, most of them women or young, and where she is seeing potential and hope. So I want to read the final thing I'm going to read to you. I think it's the last thing. Yes, as I think my time's just about up. It comes from Abdul, and Abdul, you know, well, they bought documents to prove him that he was 17, although they have no clue. But you can buy what you need, and they wanted him to be a juvenile in this case for legal reasons. And so he's been through a lot. But toward the end of the book, he says, "Well, let's say he." Maybe because of the boiling April sun, Abdul thought about water and ice. Water and ice were made of the same thing. He thought most people were made of the same thing, too. He himself was probably little different constitutionally from the cynical, corrupt people around him, the police officers and the special executive officer and the morgue doctor who fixed Kalu's death. If he had to sort all humanity by its material essence, he thought it would probably end up with a single gigantic pile. But here was the interesting thing. Ice was distinctive from, and in his view, better than, what it was made of. He wanted to be better than what he was made of. In Mumbai's dirty water, he wanted to be ice. He wanted to have ideals. For self-interested reasons, one of the ideals he most wanted to have was a belief in the possibility of justice. Well, I hope you will be intrigued enough, at least, to pick up the book, and I think I'd better stop there and ask for any questions, comments. If any of you waved at me, I didn't notice. Didn't pick it up. Comments? Yes.
You mentioned that mind you, had a college degree.
Excuse me.
You mentioned that mind you had a college degree.
She was about to graduate.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now, how did she get to be in college? Does the book go into that? Because it must be a rarity among those people.
Very rare. But the parents took any chances they got, and the government was trying very hard. They were, when I was there, when Kai and I were there, they were giving places to the backward communities. We don't have castes anymore in India, but the backward communities or the lower communities had first choice at some of the colleges. So the government did have some plans to get people into college. But when you hear what she's teaching the children, she's learning Shakespeare and she's repeating the names and the places, or she's reading other classics and teaching these to the Anawadi slum children. And then she's very good at memorizing, and so she's going to get through. You know, she's going to be through, and maybe be a teacher, and she may figure it out. But there is support. There are grants, there are loans, there is support for young children.
And she's an inspiration to her children.
Yes, she was looked up to. She was looked up to by her mother. She was also an irritant to her mother in many ways. But yeah. Other, Nancy?
Terry, you used the term documentary a couple of times. Mm-hmm. Were you referring to the fact that there is a moving picture made on this book?
No, the book is a documentary. I'm talking about it in that way.
I see.
It is a document. It's nonfiction. Mm-hmm. It is a compilation of the things that Catherine Boo observed and wrote about.
Right.
But she never tells about it in terms of I saw or I observed. Mm-hmm. She writes it as a narrative written by the people who are living it.
Yes, well,
yeah.
I might mention that there have been many documentaries on PBS about this situation in some of these
slum areas. Yeah. No, there are no. She had pictures. She doesn't include any of them except the picture on her book, but that's the only one. Yeah.
Yes. Could you say something about the title of the book?
Oh, yes. In fact, I was going to sort of end there, because every time somebody asks me the title of this book, I say it's Beyond the Beautiful Forevers. And it's not. It's Behind the Beautiful Forevers. But I keep hoping it's beyond. Somehow or other that comes to play. The beautiful, there is this fence around Anawadi, and it runs. Beautiful Forevers, Beautiful Forever. Actually singular. Beautiful Forever, Beautiful Forever. And those are the ceramic tiles. It's the brand for the ceramic tile, or the ad for the ceramic tile, that Asha wants to put in her kitchen. And it is what they try to hide the slum with. The irony you can see all over the place. Yeah. Good question. Any others? Yeah, over here.
Would you like to use this?
I have a simple question. Mm-hmm. Can you smell the slum from the hotel?
We didn't. In order to get the pictures I got, we were probably up fairly high. On the other hand, I might have been inured to it, because you smell India everywhere. I mean, there are smells that are just going on all the time. So I think if you were close to the lake, also certain seasons of the year, much worse than other, when it's rainy and monsoons and everything spilling over, it's pretty bad. But no, it's a good question. I don't remember anything like that. I remember being absolutely stunned that it was right there. But we were close. But, you know, I went through some of those areas in South India, and I don't remember odors beyond what you animals, you know, you expect to smell, and incense and things like that, spices. Yeah. Good question. Others? Yes, Craig.
I've been in a few places like that. It's been about 20 years since I was last in a place like that.
This was 95 I was there, so...
Well, I guess it's about the 30s, late close. 70s I was last in a place like this. But whenever I came out of a place like that, it was a terrible adjustment. When I leave, I think, I'm getting out of here, but these people can't. Yeah. And it gave me months to get over that once I got back here.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I just wonder, you've traveled a lot. Have you had that experience?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Does it stay with you every time you go and come back?
It stays. And, you know, you come back and you want to strip everything out of your environment and live pretty simply and close your eyes to some other things. And then you've got to come back and do what you have to do. Connie asked me to talk a little bit about my experiences in India, and I didn't want to divert very much, but one of them that came to me is that, you know, the Indian people are trying. It is a democracy, and they know their problems better than we do. They absolutely know. And I was we were at a university at Avanishalingam, and those people knew. But one of the evidences, and you know, solutions are just off the wall. But one of the solutions, I joined an extension class for high school teachers at the university. They came in from a village, or from varieties of villages, to get some updating. Yeah, sounds like what we do, right? And so they were getting updated, and I joined them on the first day. And the instructor was taking all this kind of data, but she also put all of us on the scale. We weighed in. You've got to be kidding. Why on earth are you doing this? Well, we have a grant from the government. And to prove that we are not corrupt, that we are using the grant for the food and we're not skimming it, these students must not weigh less when they leave us than when they came. Yeah, I mean, they know. They do know the problems. How do you get at corruption? With a rule like that? You know. I wanted to weigh less. Other? I know it's about one, and some of you really need to leave. So thank you so much. Oops, I just disconnected by mistake.